I want to focus on the presentation by Manufacturing Circle. I am deeply concerned by what I saw in the slide that talks about the beneficiation as manufacturing, the status quo, quarter on quarter and year on year. With that presentation, firstly, the quarter on quarter, the negative loss of 59,000 jobs, is that in the, obviously it's compared to the quarter of the first quarter, but is that 59,000 jobs that have been lost in Q2? And then secondly, with regard to the survey that you did, I find those figures quite frightening, and the declining optimism that is resulting in the manufacturing sector. If you had to put your finger on one specific concern that came back from respondents, what would that be? And do you think that that the debate that is taking place around beneficiation has any concern to those respondents? Thank you.
Thank you. The second question by Honourable Tsopu.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is to all the presenters, because they keep on complaining or raising the issues around skills shortage. So my question directly to them is, how are they planning to address this without involving government? Because they are also role players, all of them. And also, what partnership do they have with universities and technologies? And the last one is whether they succeed to recruit and retain some of the skills which are needed in various businesses or companies which presented this morning. And the other question one is also interested really to hear about is how many jobs are they creating? Because we are not just looking at beneficiation without also looking at job created vis-a-vis also job which are being lost. It is only the mineral cycle which was able really to indicate to us how many jobs did they lose in the fourth quarter and also in the second quarter, which my colleague has already addressed. The last question I have is directly to Goldstar. You alluded in your presentation that you are having fluctuating cost of raw materials due to the import parity pricing that are linked to exchange rates. Are there alternative local producers of polypropylene? If so, do they all charge import parity prices? And the second question to all the presenters is, what is driving the high cost of transport in South Africa and Africa, so that as we also link with our colleagues in the other portfolio committee, we should be in the position to put the matters clearly to them. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Tsopu. I see the hand there of Honourable Faps. I just had before you Honourable Mkangi wants to pose a question. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. No, I would like to welcome the report first. No, I want to raise a comment firstly that I think Parliament should recognize the difficulties that the sector is finding itself into at this point in time. Because only one that perhaps raised the issue was yesterday. The main issue in the minerals was the issue of the import parity prices. But that made their businesses uncompetitive, especially in South Africa, because of the profits that are being sent offshore, and it makes them not to be able to compete inside here, because the prices, when they come, they are inflated. That was the crux of the matter yesterday. But in two of the presentation, I found that you are unable perhaps for our people here, they are buying imported goods because they are cheaper. Is that what you are saying? That the major thing that kills this industry is the imported goods that are cheaper. And the goods that you are producing are more expensive, and that kills you. So I want to relate, was I'm told that from the question that the last speaker said, there is also an import parity prices. So is that the matter? The second thing that I want to, because I want to appreciate that you are doing a job on the question of beneficiation. But what I wanted to ask, firstly to the land, to the manufacturing cycle, that as you are winning perhaps the fight on beneficiation, what is the structure of the ownership of the plastic industry? You have organizations that participate there in your cycle or circle. What is the structure today? The last question that I wanted to ask is the question that which part of the laws that exist today do you want the government to strengthen in order to defend this industry? You know, from being destroyed, because there are many who had a problem with the clothing industry, with the Chinese goods and so forth. So what interventions could the state do to save this particular industry? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Nkongi. Honorable Fabs.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Yes, one certainly welcomed all of the presentations this morning, notwithstanding one had to address certain issues. But in starting with my manufacturing circle there, Chairperson, I just wanted to check with the manufacturing circle. They have a number of members in that circle as such. If they've done a study which would be looking at some of the impediments with respect to the parity pricing issue on the one hand, the cost of other inputs, and the capacity of the market to absorb their products. And what measures are they taking, and what measures can we take recommend to the department to take? The other one was also dealing with that in terms of the beneficiation of recyclable materials. I, for one, was not aware that these are often more job-intensive and less energy-intensive. And I think it's something that is of pertinence because we're trying to promote job creation. And then on regard to the plastics here with this the diamond or whatever, circle of life, as they would say in The Lion King. Well, look here, this integrated approach to the beneficiation, I actually thought, Chairperson, that this was really very constructive. It does give us a different angle on things, and certainly it is one that brings in all the issues that we are trying to tackle in that particular regard. But it would be helpful when you spoke about, at one stage, there was one of your graphs here. You indicated 2011 or something being a very poor year, obviously. Then it jumped on in 2012, 5.4%, the market share, whatever. And then we dropped again in 2013, quite dramatically. And it would have been useful if we'd had a clear understanding, because it has appeared to have been a fluctuating rise and fall from 2002. On the final one, Chairperson, with your indulgence, the issues around the health, which is a very, very high cost area to consumers. And yet we also learn, and I hope I'm not correct, you were indicating many factories or whatever have closed down in this area. What can be done to resuscitate them? Why did they close down in the first place? Because we do need them, and the tooling area as well. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honourable Fabs. I'm now going to give each presenter an opportunity to answer their questions. We'll start off with Manufacturing Circle. Mr. Bisay, note please.
Thanks, Jay. I'll obviously have to be very brief, so if there's additional remarks required, then I'll wait for instruction at the end. Audemars McPherson, the 59,000 jobs, according to the stats received from SatSA, were lost between the first quarter and the second quarter. The biggest issue being registered at that time by manufacturers and surveys, by PMI, etc., points to labour instability as the chief issue. A big difficulty, as I alluded earlier, is that manufacturers, labour action may happen, but the market requires still for their demands to be met. And if these manufacturers are going to be chosen to meet that demand, then they have to ensure that they remain competitive and that they supply at a consistent rate. In order to do that, some of the manufacturers are necessarily reverting to automation of certain activities and to importing certain input requirements rather than manufacturing those locally. There are anecdotes that I can share in this respect, but I won't because of a limit of time. There is no particular silver bullet, but what we definitely do need is more of what is referred to as joined-up government. It needs to be easier for us to get five ministers into a room focused on manufacturing at a particular point, saying these are the three things that we can tackle at a short, within a relatively short period of time. Take, for instance, an issue such as administered prices, which needs to be addressed across government departments, but there's also been numerous documents that have been compiled, that's gathering dust and so on. Action can be taken. There are numerous recommendations that have been made throughout the year, many of which are quite sensible. So that's the kind of thing that we need. Let's get five members of the executive together who takes a decision and say, we are now going to tackle this particular thing. And some of these things are admittedly very difficult, but it needs to be done. To the Honourable Tsoko, we operate a corporate association that represents manufacturers across the different manufacturing categories. The industry development organisations and the employer organisations have a number of them have got particular wings that look at skills development in their particular sectors. What I can tell you is that the big manufacturers will have programs that stretch all the way from pre-primary right through to supporting postdoctoral engineering students at overseas universities and areas of specialization that we may not, for instance, cover in South Africa. There are some that have invested together that cooperate in their particular manufacturing category, setting up training institutions, working with their CETOs to do those kind of things. Skills shortage is an issue across the world. It's always a chicken and the egg situation, but I don't think necessarily it's something that will stop investment if the rewards are there. A plan will always be made. I think what we need to do as a country is look at our secondary and primary education system delivers better and more even outcomes, because that will produce students that are much more workers that are much more trainable, upskillable, and marketable and productive. With regards to transport, it's very hard because I didn't canvass manufacturers on every single issue. What I can tell you about transport is that port charges, for instance, a huge impediment in relation to our export competitiveness. It's structured in the wrong way. It incentivizes the exports of raw materials rather than manufactured goods. There is some work that's been done in the automotive sector that have yielded certain results subsequent to a consultation with the President, I think, by NAMSA. And we'll remember it was mentioned in the State of the Nation 2 years ago. So that kind of action needs to be broadened. Do I need to stop?
No, you can continue, but just try to tie up.
Okay. So in terms of imported goods, import parity pricing is also very much, there are a range of views within manufacturing. So for us that represents different categories, it's very difficult to give a definitive point of view. But I would like to pass that difficult question on to the industry associations that are here, the plastics and steel, perhaps they could give a better indication. Laws to be strengthened, I think in many cases, I won't be able to be specific now, but in many cases it's more about enforcement. Imports, for instance, it's not about laws that need to be changed, it's about enforcement that needs to be done. There are battles that have been won through customs and so on, but there's still a lot of work that needs to be caught up with. Then Honourable Fubs, the different manufacturers obviously study the market all the time. I think what we found is that if we are serious about local procurement and not about sheltering uncompetitive industries, we need to look at what is a sensible differential that we can allow local manufacturers, at which price we can say we will procure. We in the private sector will also commit to procure because we know there will be positive economic outcomes rather than us creating negative economic outcomes at the end of the day. There are economies where costs are very, very high because of behavior that's too protectionist, and invariably the poor will suffer. So we don't want that situation, but we do need to look at those kind of things. And then just with respect to the beneficiation of ores versus the beneficiation of scrap, the foundry people will tell you in particular that the beneficiation of ores is often what people think of when we speak about beneficiation, but it's capital intensive and energy intensive, doesn't create a hell of a lot of jobs. If we speak about turning scrap, for instance, into widgets and components and so on, that kind of activity, although also energy intensive, creates much more jobs, doesn't focus on capital in particular, and potentially that's the area where we need to start with beneficiation and then move up the value chain from there.
Thank you, Mr. Besaidnert. Now, Mr. Honokom from Plastics SA, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I will try and respond to some of the questions, and it might link, so if that's fine. If I can respond to Honourable Tsoko's question around skill shortages. Plastics SA, one of our main functions is training of the industry. We train more than 3,000 learners per annum. Some of them are learnerships, which is a full-year program. Others are shorter skills programs, also leading to the same qualification at the end of the day. We are very active involved with the MERCETA from a chamber viewpoint, where we influence certain skills. So on the lower NKF levels 2 to 5, there's a lot of activities taking place. We do, on the higher levels, it's been mentioned that universities of technology have phased out polymer science qualifications. That's a lack of number of students and support. It's also a matter of that the qualifications were no longer aligned to the needs of the industry, and therefore these people were not really accepted in the context. We have discussions and we engage with higher education. For example, we've just now completed a new qualification curriculum that we've jointly developed with the Tshwane University of Technology for material science. It's a BEng qualification, material science, and the focus will specifically on polymers. And the end goal is that will become a polymer science, polymer material science qualification. That's the sort of skills on the high level that we need. We've lost a lot of technical managers. We have the management skills, but the technical experience to make decisions on the polymer itself and the processing, we've lost that. There was a huge brain drain into the UK and Australia early 2000s. So there's a lot of work done by the industry. If I just go back to when we do learnerships and things, companies are involved. We do both the theory, the practical, but also workplace components. So individual companies are involved to provide the workplace experience for these learners. So they, if you're employed, obviously you will do it to the company. If it's unemployed people, they will be absorbed by the industry providing the practical and therefore also workplace opportunities after that. So the exit strategy is in place. We did not have any artisans before. We've just recently created an artisan qualification for machine setters. This process is currently stuck between SACWA and the QCTO in terms of the new changes in terms of occupational qualifications. It has to be then also, because it's a new trade test and things need to be developed. So we're in that process, but it's taking far too long in terms of the need. As I mentioned before, in terms of the MSEP, we've applied for 120 artisans to be trained in setters. The reason for that is that the setters are changing from their mandate. There's a lot more support for NSFAS and those sort of tertiary education than workplace experience, which is creating a huge pressure for industry in the sense that they can't develop the internal staff, specifically employed people. There's also an articulation problem between what's happening at companies into higher education, so that seems to be a problem. If I can move on to some of the other questions, the fluctuation of pricing, polymers is a commodity, so it's linked to the fuel price. We all know that the fuel price is daily fluctuating, and that directly has an impact on the industry. Which makes it difficult for the industry in terms of planning as well, because the changes in the price, you don't always know what your cost and how to go forward in terms of your planning and your pricing strategy. So those sort of things has a problem, creates a problem. Also, very often increases cannot be filtered down to the retailers and so on. We do come up against cheap imports, and very often the question is, but we can get the same product in one of our overseas offices for cheaper than here. So there's a lot of pressure to reduce price locally. Part of the problem is that our market is so much smaller. We do need to make a lot of mold changes and things that takes time. Where internationally, you run one product on one machine, 365 days, you can just tune it out. It's just happening in South Africa. We need to do mold changes based on that. The question around Honorable Nkongi's question, we sit with cheap imports that's coming in. So the playing field is often not level. We sit with compliance costs in terms of certain legislation requirements, which is world class, that we need to comply with, and that raised probably your baseline with 10-15%. Imported material doesn't have that sort of baseline, and therefore the playing field is not even. Yes, the World Trade Organization say you can't subsidize import products and things. If one look at China, if you look at a finished product, it will come into South Africa at a price equal to the raw material price. And the only explanation for that is that there's subsidies. So if they export a finished product, it's subsidized. If you take the same product and you break it down into components, let's say it's a roll of film, but it's going onto a core. If you just want to import the core, which is an input into our process, that is even more expensive than a complete product. And that indicates there's specific strategies in China that support the exports in contrary to the World Trade Organization agreements, and that we can't compete. So even in line with that, we're busy with SARS at the moment to build up a risk engine on certain import or tariff codes to look at reference pricing, to look at what's coming and how we can monitor it in order to try and avoid these sort of activities.
Thank you very much. Thirdly, Acacia Healthcare, Mr. Allen. Any questions have been posed that you'd need to answer?
Sorry, Honourable Fabs, just to answer your question, just regarding the closure of factories. In our case, it's not necessarily the case of the closure of factories, but more reducing our staff contingent and reacting to contracts we gain or lose in time. But in the industry itself, over the last couple of years, there have been a few major liquidations of huge local manufacturing companies. We have to be very quick to respond to any changes in our business to make sure we have a sustainable the supply chain, which was pretty different, pretty difficult retake, and a lot of processes and workflows within our industry as well, just to, or should I say, within our company, to fine-tune our cost base to keep afloat. But it's a very price-competitive market in the medical industry at the moment, and I've explained to you the reasons why. So we would love to increase the workforce in our facility, and as you said previously, we would love to have you there to inspect it and have a look at what we do. Very proud of what we have there, and it gives me great satisfaction to see us employing so many local people as well. Honourable Mkongi, we just with regards to how government can help us with the pricing strategies and the costing of our raw materials preventing cheaper products to come in is basically trying to work out some type of a point system, as with many other industries, and try and implement that in our industry as well, with regards to our facility and the quality standards that are required of us, to then give us a point schedule and then make sure that people then give us some type of preference when it comes to menu or procuring from us. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Lastly, Mr. Baruch from Gold Sun Industries.
Honourable Member Tsoko.
Excuse me. Sorry, Mr. Allen, can you just switch off your mic, please? Thank you very much. Thanks.
Honourable Member Tsoko, you've asked me regarding the import parity pricing and the alternative suppliers. Sasol is the largest, and not single, there's another producer of polypropylene in South Africa, they're called Safripol. Safripol get their feedstocks, however, from Sasol. So Sasol is in control of the cost of it. So there are only two local producers. Both of them work on similar policies in terms of import parity pricing and the pricing strategies that they choose. So that answers that question. In terms of, you asked me regarding training, the universities, we have, as I said, a lack of skilled and semi-skilled staff. We take in people from Atlantis, which some of them don't even finish schools. We train them in-house, we give them skills of how to operate our machinery, how to all sorts of other activities that happen within our factory, raw material knowledge. We give them forklift training, we give them to operate other machinery there. So we are trying to improve skills in terms of our labor force. What I was saying, it's difficult for a company to expand and to find skills outside its own resources because there's no new artisans that are coming into, there's no pool of artisans that you can find to sustain the business and to grow the business, which is what we are trying to do. We're at the moment a growing business. I'm fortunate to say that. We're not losing jobs. We are creating jobs. And one of our challenges is the finding of the skills to provide for our growth without training people that are unskilled to bring them to skilled, to semi-skilled or skilled levels. We have not engaged the universities. I am a company. Maybe I should have, but we have not engaged university. I don't have the access to the people who I would have to talk to in terms of, it's not something that me as a business person is something that I normally would get involved. I would take it up maybe with the Association of Plastics South Africa to engage university, but us as a business maybe have not done enough to try and create better education for our industry. In terms of imported goods and transport, maybe I'm mixing the questions that Mr. Mkongi, Honourable Member Mkongi. I don't know the answers, why the structural answers to why things are cheaper. The fact of the matter is that, as Mr. Hanekom has said, to import certain things, the freight from Hong Kong to South Africa is cheaper than from Durban to Joburg. As I mentioned, in my case, where I exported some goods to Malaysia and the cost was much cheaper. It could be due to lack of infrastructure, rail infrastructure, due to high fuel costs. I don't have the answer to give you why there are structural changes, whether the companies that are in this country are not competitive enough. I don't think that's the case. So I hope that I've... Now, in terms of the laws, Honourable Member McConkie, you know, in my industry, we obviously supply a lot of the retailers, as mentioned, the Games and the ShopRite. If government could do more to regulate the amount of imports that they are bringing into the country and to have better local support, I'm not sure whether it's something that the government could do. But I think in terms of product presentation, labeling products that are South African-made and labeling imported products, maybe in the consumer mind, to know that they're supporting South Africa, as was said previously, to try and promote more the proudly South African products in the retail, so there's more local support from the local sector to retail to South African manufacturers. I'll make a small example regarding local procurement of government that I was involved in last year, which I, because my BE score is not good enough, I've had to go through an intermediary that is an importer of products, where I would supply my plastic chairs and tables. There were other products that government was procuring that I could manufacture, but I have no access to that. Government is not engaged for procurement, and the volumes were high. Local industry for procurement of certain goods that are currently imported, that would make sense for me to go and invest in tooling and start local production. There's not enough interaction between the government and the industry. So I think if that would happen, it would improve the situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Baruch. Mr. Honekom wanted to add something from Plastics SA.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe just a critical point that I want the portfolio community to just take note of. If we talk preferential procurement, it's very often government doesn't procure plastic specifically. If you procure, for example, HIV test kits, it's about the test kits and the chemicals in that. And very often when you look at designation, is that plastics per se is not designated. And we have difficulties getting products designated. Government is not procuring pens. They buy that through stationery and different contracts. So on a secondary level, plastics very often needs to be identified and maybe on a broader level designated. And maybe the sector, like in Brazil, should be designated to say certain percentages should be locally produced. If we procure nurses' clothing, for example, the shoes that procure is plastic, except we don't get into those cross-cutting economic sectors as well, and therefore we lose opportunities where the local industry can be beneficiated, where there's benefit. And that's important to note that preferential procurement as it stands now doesn't directly help us, if that can be noted. Very often also, tenders goes out for 2 years. The industry have capacity. They often need to do tooling and just change, which incur cost. A typical mold could be hundreds of thousands of rand. Very often the offset is not big enough to justify the investment. So one has to look at how those things are combined at the end of the day as well. So if there's a guaranteed takeoff for syringes for a number of years, the investment that is normally recovered over 20 years or 10 years can be justified. But if it's only a 1 year or 2 year contract, that makes that sort of economics very difficult. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Honekom. We have now unfortunately run out of time. I wanted to allow a second round of questions from the members, but I think the best way to arrange that is for you to write down your questions, which will be submitted to the various presenters, and the presenters themselves are also welcome if they want to submit any further information in writing to the committee. You're more than welcome to do that by Monday for consideration. And that brings us to the conclusion of this round. Honourable Nkosi.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I'm sorry to do that. I asked a very important question. No one answered it. Maybe it's going to be important that I request the Chairperson to request the presenters, especially Plastic South Africa and the manufacturing sector, to provide us with the information on the ownership patterns of these companies. Who is there and what is the ownership pattern? So I think it's very important, because if we're going to propose these things, I'm listening to your difficulty that government does not take you because your scores in terms of the PE codes, you are failing them. And that is very fundamental when we're going to be debating this thing with government. So we must have information on the ownership patterns and the question of the PE codes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Mkongi. I suppose you have taken note of that, so that's not going to be a written question, but the members are free to submit written questions. And well, that brings us to the end of this round of presenters. Thank you very much for coming. We really appreciate your inputs and liaising with the committee. Thank you very much.
Right, thank you very much, Honourable Advocate Anton Alberts. Really appreciate you chairing there. Members, in the earlier round, some people did extend themselves into 20 minutes and 25. We really don't have that kind of time. If anyone would like to return, we're going to make that available. We're also going to try and accommodate you in oversight visits, which is sometimes even more effective. So we're looking at a short, sharp international seminar stuff where you get given 7 minutes, but we're going to double that up. We're going to give you 15 minutes, as is noted here. So it's NIASA, CIFSA, Steel, Zimco Group, 15 minutes each, please. Get your main thrust out immediately. Who's coming here from NIASA? Because I'll just have to go up to the desk where I've got everything. And we really would like to indicate our appreciation for how it's gone so far. Mr. Papenfuss, is that Mr. Gerhardt?
Down there.
I believe you will speak to your presentation. That presentation is NIASA. Have we all got that, members? Have we all got the presentation? Because it looks like this. I certainly have it handed out.
Okay.
It's a two-pager, and have you all got it? Yes. Now, this is just a very short... I think, Mr. Papenfuss, you're basically going to sort of broadly introduce the area to us. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you, and thank you, Honourable Members of Parliament. This is a very unique opportunity for us. I'm going to focus on one particular area. There's a lot of technical detail that's been conveyed this morning, and I think the persons that will be coming after me will address issues that I could have addressed, but I think in terms of, for purpose of the time limitation, I will not address. Although this debate, if you can call it that, is about beneficiation. I want to address one particular issue that has a huge impact on beneficiation. I want to focus on the metal engineering industry, and then especially focus on the Metal Engineering Industry Council, which impacts on what's happening in this industry. If we do not sort out this industry, this council, then whatever we do will not have sufficient impact. The workings of this council has completely denied the industry flexibility, and I think that is perhaps the crux of the problems that the industry is experiencing. We're dealing with a big and diverse industry. The industry is hugely diverse, both in terms of the role players, the size of the role players, very big business located in the metropoles to the very small companies, also located in the metropoles but also in rural areas. And there are a lot of different sectors within this industry. And I've made a list of that on page one of my presentation. I do not want to repeat that. But this industry cannot be completely understood without an understanding of the role and impact of the Metal Industries Bargaining Council. And unless you solve the problem with this council, nothing whoever does will have the required effect. The diverse nature of this industry in all respects, coupled with the one-size-fits-all nature of the approach of the Metal Industry Bargaining Council, lies at the root of the dilemma manufacturing finds itself in. And I'm saying this particularly from the point of view of small and medium-sized enterprise. Any attempt to address the industry's challenges to make this industry a wealth creator, creator of wealth, and a creator of jobs will not succeed unless the MEIBC is unpacked, understood, and transformed. The industry, Madam Chair, is in a process of decline. I reckon over approximately a period of 30 years, this industry has lost 700,000 jobs. Over the last 5 years, to my understanding, the industry lost 250,000 jobs. Economists reckon that we are currently on the level of employment that we were 42 years ago in 1972. And although the global factors have played a role in the decline of the industry, this industry, through the Metal Industry Bargaining Council, has been its own worst enemy. The council has choked this industry, and especially SMMEs, and unless this is addressed, nothing will solve this industry's problems. Bargaining Council is not the industry's only problem, but it plays a very important role in the slow death of this industry. The council, bargaining council system has created the platform from where big employers and trade unions could create a world which suited them, but which choked SMMEs. And we all know that the National Development Plan says that if we are going to create the number of jobs that we want to create by 2030, 90% of those jobs will be created by SMMEs. But if we want to do that, we'll have to change this environment dramatically. The problem that we have in this dispensation is that SMMEs, which we hope will be the big job creator, has no say in the outcome of the MEIBC's dispensations, if you can call it that. Arrangements negotiated in Johannesburg by big unions and big business are enforced on SMMEs and those arrangements simply does not suit that of SMMEs. An arrangement that suits a big company in Johannesburg does not suit a small business in the Northern Cape. And that is because every aspect of business differs between that of a big business and a small business. In respect of all the important elements of business, raw material, transport, energy, finance, labor costs, and I can continue with this list, the cost structure of a small business differs from that of a big business, and it makes a difference if you are situated in Johannesburg or in Kuruman, for instance. Unfortunately, the Labor Relations Act, in the way it is currently structured, is a culprit in this regard, and it denies small business a say in the outcome of these agreements, and to give the final say to big trade unions and big business. And I believe this arrangement is the single most important reason for the deindustrialization of the industry and the decline of manufacturing in South Africa. So what do we do, madam? I'm going to the last page of my presentation. What is the future of this industry? 80% of employers in this industry, which we've canvassed, say they do not see a future in this industry, and they all agree that the council has to be transformed. And of course, there are other things that need to happen, which was discussed this morning, and which will be addressed later in other presentations. Can the industry be saved? Yes. But only if the role of the MEIBC in the industry is effectively dealt with. What is the challenge of this industry? South Africa has become fundamentally uncompetitive in the manufacturing environment. South Africa must be turned from the manufacturing environment must be switched from a penalty to an advantage. And we need to create an environment that lure young people and entrepreneurs to this industry. At the moment, this nobody that understands this industry has any interest in opening a business in this industry. What about industrial policy? We must reverse deindustrialization. And this is crucial. And I want to point this out, that the difference between long-term deindustrialization and a recession is this. When the economy recovers, people that is now manufacturing their products elsewhere and importing those products do not return. That is not the case with a recession. We must become strategically competitive again. If you look at China, there's a saying that goes that the man who got to the top did not fall there. Now, China did not become the world's industrial powerhouse by doing nothing. They became that. They became what they are because of a predictable, sustained, and deliberate industrial policy, something we are lacking. And that makes it very hard to compete with them. In China, manufacturers are treated like kings. It's not necessarily the case here. We must treat manufacturing as a critical wealth creator. And that is exactly what manufacturing can be if we get this right. On the point of the youth, young people do not find work in this industry anymore. It's become simply too expensive to employ them. And this industry must play a role in transforming the youth as being a current liability for this country to become our biggest asset. We've got the young people, and they need to be utilized in this industry. Currently, not the case. And then we need to understand labor in this industry. This industry, through the working of the Metro Industry Bargaining Council, has become 40% more expensive than competing industries. And I'm referring to the motor industry, the road transport industry, other big industries. It now costs an employer 100,000 rand cost to company to employ a young person without any education and without any skills. And the argument, of course, is then that the employer can get an exemption, which is the whole system of exemption is dysfunctional. There's no regional dispensation. So the guy in Kuruman, when he employs a young person with no skills, very little education, that the cost to company of that person will be 100,000 rand. So what this industry is saying is, unless you manufacture something where a job will give a general worker 100,000 rand, you give that job to China. We've given hundreds of thousands of jobs to China. In conclusion, madam, this is a very serious problem, and it is something that needs to be addressed. And I thought it was important that you understand this particular point. The last thing I want to say is this, that the MEIBC, from a point of socio-economic growth and stability, has become a liability for South Africa and needs to be addressed urgently. Thank you, madam.
Your understanding, Mr. Gerhardt Papenfuss, thank you very much. And that did just give us the direction there, thank you. And now we have Saifasa, and we've got coming from there, representing them. Is it Mr. Kaiser? I'm not sure who's going to be doing it. Inyat Sumba, the CEO, or is it Mr. Henk Langehoven? Mr. Bob Stone.
Okay.
I'm not sure who's doing the presentation.
It will be all three of us. I'll lead the presentation.
Why don't you lead it? Why don't you? Yeah.
Good day, honorable members of Parliament. My name is Kaiser Netsumba, CEO of SIFSA. With me are colleagues, Henk Langehoven to my right, who is the chief economist of SIFSA, and Mr. Bob Stone, who is the sales and marketing director at Zimco Group, a company that is in one of the associations that are members of SIFSA. He is himself a chairman of the Non-Ferrous Metal Industries Association. Honorable Chair, SIFSA has been in existence for 71 years. It represents 27 industry associations that are employers in this sector, and they collectively have more than 2,000 companies represented. And those companies in turn employ more than 210,000 people. The important point to stress here, Madam Chair, is that the vast majority of the companies that are represented through SIFSA, 63% of them, are small companies that employ fewer than 50 people. So they are small companies that are SMMEs, and they've been very active within both SIFSA structures and indeed the MEIBC structures. SIFSA offers a whole variety of services to its members and those outside of the metals and engineering sector, and the services are listed there. I will not go into them. I do want to spend some time on the training center that we have. We have a training center based in Benoni that trains artisans for the metals and engineering sector. It is a training center that's accredited by three CETAs, the MERCETA, the CHITA, and the EWCETA. And in addition to training artisans for the industry, and for the industry, we also offer on an annual basis bursaries to 10 students who are at different universities across the country. Madam Chair, we welcome the opportunity to be part of this discussion. We consider beneficiation to be of such importance to our economy, but also would like to contend that it is a very complex endeavor that requires, on the part of government, a coordinated policy approach. Our market is a relatively small one to support the scale of production needed in this sector. The metals and engineering sector is highly exposed to the international market. So 60% of the products that are produced in South Africa are exported, but at the same time, 60% of the products, so the metals and engineering products in the country, are imported. So imports are a considerable competition to the metals and engineering sector here and pose a significant threat. And we also need to ensure that we are competitive domestically and we do more export, to especially in the region. Madam Chair, the international supply chains are complex and driven by global cost optimization. And an example here that we will cite and our chief economist will talk more about is that of catalytic converters. It is our view that approaching sector dynamics holistically has a better chance of success than an approach that's based on the stages of production. And we also have the view that there's a need for higher levels of policy coordination on the part of government that would appear to be the case at the moment. And we also argue, Madam Chair, that logistics, energy and administrative prices are additional key determinants of success, and indeed the presentations that were made this morning would have indicated the extent to which administered prices and logistics add to the cost of the products that our members produce in the local market. My colleague will now proceed with the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And that was the Steel and Engineering Industries Federation Southern Africa. You are still going to continue, but just so that everyone knows exactly what the acronym is, I thought that would be useful, Mr. Nia Tsumba.
Thank you very much, ma'am. We appreciate it.
Madam Chair, thank you, my man Klangenhoven. Thanks for the opportunity. We in basically have the same argument as the plastics people that a holistic approach to the issue of beneficiation would work better. We try to stick to the questions that you asked, and this is the widest definition of the steel and engineering sector. Of course, the plastics people spoke for themselves, the rubber people, and we're not talking on behalf of the motor industry, etc. If I can just give you an idea of the breakdown of the costs and what is in each. This is the input structure, intermediary inputs, in other words, what we're buying, and the next slide I will show you what it is and what the components are. Remuneration for employees, about 18% of production costs. 5% is fixed capital, in other words, the machinery and equipment that we use, and then the profit margins are actually quite low. This is the breakdown of what we buy to make what we produce eventually. Primary industries, of course, the mining industry, and then all the rest below that. What I want to highlight is the electricity and gas, which has been highlighted by other people. On average, 4 to 5%. If you add petroleum as part of energy, it becomes a little bit higher. And then transport and storage, also 4%. Some of these things are... The problem with most of them is if you don't have electricity, you can't do what you need to do. So that even though small, they are actually quite crucial. And this is the message, that we think it's better to approach this from an holistic point of view and look at input cost and all the other issues in the production line. Just to stress what my CEO has said, it seems as if the worldwide literature is saying that it's good that you have the endowment, but if administrative cost, logistics, energy is an important part of it, you can almost nullify the benefit of having that. And just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, what you see here is actually the steel and engineering sector. On the left-hand side, you see the inputs. The green is what is provided domestically, 181 billion. The imports, and I will talk about that a little bit further, is the imports of intermediate products and often machinery and equipment that we cannot work without. then the sector adds 74 billion, of which about 75% is going to wages and then split in the rest. On the right-hand side, you have outputs in the order of 306 billion in 2013. The final product that you see there in red is the 108. That's final products that are directly competing with our sector. Then the one that's just above it is 180 billion intermediate imports that are also directly competing. So if we talk about import penetration, like Mr. Nyansumba has said, the 60% import penetration is actually those two components. And then for the domestic market is about 118 billion. I'm not going to go much further, but you will see here on the right how much goes into fixed investment. It goes into mining mainly, the auto sector and the construction sector. So we're very, very interrelated amongst each other. And this is the concept that you probably can intervene on each one of these points. And I'm not going to go to save time into much of it, but you can look at input costs and provision of input. You can look at imports, and I'll come back to that. You can look at helping to invest in terms of capital equipment. We will do, and we are doing a lot in terms of people. And then on the output side, the exports and what goes to the domestic market. All of these process along the line intervention possibilities are along the line possible. There's a summary of it. I'm not going to go into much detail, and it's just to give you an idea of what we're talking about. What we see and what I'm trying to convey to you with the next number of slides is the dynamics that we have been experiencing in the sector over the last number of years, actually decades. And there was a question, or someone picked up that it was quite volatile, the input prices. That is actually a very, very important characteristic of our sector. What has happened, capacity utilization has been way below the 85% full capacity. That's what we see as full capacity in our sector. Hence, problems with investment, which I'll come to later. Cost pressures is a very important matter. And input price escalation is, I'll show you a graph about the intermediate PPI is 70, we are 70% of that intermediate PPI, and you will see how much higher it runs than the CPI and the overall headline PPI. Administered prices for us is more than 10% of our costs. And then we have said about the competing imports, but what has been happening lately, and Kunrad de Seydenhout has been mentioning it, and I'll show you a graph that shows because of the cost and because of the competition that are subsidized from outside, our companies are starting to import components and assemble products here, which is, in other words, if you think back at the schematic that I had, the intermediate imports are now competing with actually stuff that some of our components of the sector manufactured ourselves. The exchange rate is often said and shown and motivated as the big culprit. It is a double-edged sword. If it's low, if you have depreciation, you get more for your exports, but you're caught by the fact that all your imports are getting more expensive, and every unit of production is then more expensive. And then the combination of the rising domestic costs and competition of imports has done what I've said there. Import competition resulted in gross fixed investment and value added of production, the value of production capacity to come down, and I'll show you the slide. When you see that, you will see exactly what I mean. And then the fact that the sector itself is starting to cut out. In America, they call it offshoring. You buy components from another country and you just assemble it inside. So let me show you the capacity utilization. If you see there where 85% lies, and the numbers goes back to 1986, how few of the years we were above actually 85%. So it's no wonder that we had not much in terms of investment in the sector. This is, I spoke about the intermediate costs that are putting pressure on profits. This is what we see. The final manufactured goods costs rises are is the blue line. The red is intermediate cost. And you will just see, I mean, we're talking about 6% CPI. Just see where that intermediate costs are. This is just to show you the administered prices and why we're saying it's more than 10%. This is what is happening with imports and exports. The little bars are showing you the net trade balance, In other words, are we, if we're below the line, we're importing more than what we're exporting. The purple or red line, for I don't know what color that is, shows you the percentage of the domestic market that is supplied by imports. In other words, direct competition for our sector. The green line is how much we are exporting, and you can see how that pattern has shifted over a long period of time. Hence, we're talking about the competition from outside. This is just the terms of trade and the competitiveness in terms of our prices and our exchange rate.
Interrupt you. I should have announced this earlier, and I will do so as he's leaving. The chairperson of Energy joined us. He was chairing. He does need to leave though now. So I'm sorry about that.
Thanks, Chair. This is actually the heart of what we are saying. What you see here is the blue line is the value of capacity of production, plotted on the total production in each year. The red line on the other side is how much has been invested every year relative to the production that took place. And this is the worrying thing, that from 94, 95, there was quite an upsurge between 85 and 86, in other words, preparing for future growth and future production. And it has turned around. You can see clearly the two sort of double camel humps that we see here. If we cannot turn this around, then there's no industry left. And then the factor that I've been saying, that there seems to be a pattern that the companies are starting to import the more repetitive manufactured products that have been made in South Africa before. And just see, this graph is the wrong way around. So 2013 is the first one. You will see there, it's imports as a percentage of intermediate products. How much is imported now that was bought in South Africa? 35%. And the imports as a percentage of output. The output is much bigger. So you get that clear pattern. This we need to investigate much more. And we will do so. So in conclusion, manufacturing is critically important. It is vital that government plays a role, and I want to leave that schematic in your mind of where the intervention possibilities are. A lot of the policies are already doing that. International supply chains are complex, and if I can stop there, can I just use the example of catalytic converters? We have platinum and we have steel. We buy both of that, we import chemicals, and we import the monolith in the middle. Then we put it together and we export it to Germany. It gets put into an engine, which is exported back to South Africa, assembled in a BMW, and exported to China. That's how complex these supply chains are. And I hope I convey to you the dynamics, that it's not as simple as saying, but the input cost is the only thing that we must focus on. Thank you, Chair. I think I must stop there. I think the others is really self-explanatory.
I must say, you may have forgotten, but 2 years ago, we spent 2 months on this area, the iron, the steel, the admin prices. I'm sure you all remember that from the steel industry. And we actually got the cost of port prices cut.
Yes.
Because of, you know, so we're old friends there. That's why I can afford to just ask you to be cut. Okay. Zimco Group, also part of the steel engineering. Who is that? Yourself, sir, from
yes.
The Zimco, and that is Mr. Bob Stone.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and members and ladies and gents. As an introduction to the overview of Zimco Group, we are a $2 billion a year business in South Africa. We're South Africa's leading producer of industrial and base minerals and a major producer and supplier of lead, zinc, and aluminium metals, alloys, related chemicals, and engineering plastics. The majority of the metals and alloys are beneficiated from locally sourced scrap metal. Zimco was purchased by Ecobat Technologies Limited in 1999, and Ecobat Technologies is the parent company for a group of companies engaged in the smelting, manufacturing, marketing of lead and lead products with operations in the UK, France, Germany, Italy, Austria, the USA. The group benefits up to beneficiates up to 40% of the world's scrap lead and is a leader in the field of scrap metal beneficiation. The various divisions in ZIMCO are listed in the presentation. I won't run through them. I think it's important just to highlight some of the products that are beneficiated from the scrap metal. These are supplied up the value chain and in many cases to finished goods manufacturers, as indicated below. Lead, it's a very environmentally sensitive metal. It's extremely important for the production of automotive batteries, anodes in the mining industry, lead oxide paint, explosive fuses and armaments, and both sinkers in the hobby and the industrial fishing industries, also in hospitals and other industries for X-ray protection. When we look at zinc, since the closure of South Africa's only primary zinc producer, the importance of zinc scrap has increased significantly. It is used in the production of fertilizers for farming, the production of automotive tires, galvanizing, protecting our metals, door furniture, locks, and paints. Aluminium. It's used in the production of foundry alloys that produce automotive components, electrical reticulation for furniture for overhead pylons, streetlights, armaments, computer cases and components, office and garden furniture, fire extinguishers. It's produced into deoxidants, ingots and pellets without which steel making could not continue. Alloys for the production of extrusion billets for doors, window frames, tubes, automotive components, alloy wheels. Aluminium powders for the production of explosives for underground rock breaking. Production of potable water purification chemicals to ensure safe drinking water for South Africa. The exothermic reduction of ores and waste metal oxides to metal, thus saving high uses of electricity. This process is currently used in the exothermic productions of manganese, vanadium, tin, and chrome metals. Some of the manufacturing stages that this scrap metal goes through is the collection, purchase, mechanical and manual sorting of the scrap metal, melting, smelting and alloying, casting into ingots, sows or pellets, die casting, atomizing, milling, rolling, extruding, all of these are beneficiation value adding processes. Then we get to fabrication and assembly, packing and distribution. Scrap metal is sometimes the forgotten but extremely important and critical South African resource, without which the South African economy could not function, as indicated previously. The importance to the South African economy of other critical scrap metals, not currently processed by our group, but beneficiated by some of South Africa's leading industrial companies and members of CIPSA, are copper scrap, the production of water reticulation tubing and fittings in our houses, medical gas tubing, refrigeration tubing, solar panels, electrical reticulation, bus bars, cable lugs, geyser bodies, welding tips for the automotive industry. Brass, which is an alloy of zinc and copper, used in the production of military bullets and shell cases, detonator cases, doors and window frames, fire retardant equipment, sprinkler heads, locks, water reticulation taps, shower heads, and a multitude of various valves. Tungsten, the production of drill bits and drill heads for underground mining. Tooling, plugs and dies in tube drawing and extrusion industries, engineering cutting tools for lathes, machining, etc. These products are critical to South Africa, and all of these products are made from scrap metal, not from minerals dug out of the ground. some of the input costs for Zimalco, a secondary aluminium smelter, we've heard some of them mentioned before. The raw material cost of that scrap metal is as much as between 54% to 70%, on average around 62% of the cost of production. Electricity is 3.4%, Sasol gas 5.5%, repairs, maintenance, packing, transport 21.7%. The cost of external transport comes out at about 3.5%. Some of the factors critical to ensuring that we have local beneficiation: the availability of quality and affordable quantities of scrap metal. The export of South African scrap metal has increased significantly during the current decade. This has become very evident, as shown in the South African stats, partly due to the significant increase of international traders who continue, excuse the word, to rape the country of this most valuable asset. Industry first approached government in 1999 due to the decrease in international competitiveness in the beneficiation of non-ferrous scrap metals. Request for an export duty on scrap metal. Currently, we have a price preference system managed by the EDD and ITAC, which is not effective at this point in time. And we've actually seen the prices of scrap increase by as much as 32% in recent years. I leave it there, Madam Chairperson. I think all of the finer details are in the circulated presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We are looking at ways of addressing the time situation, which was raised with us yesterday. And in fact, as I said, we have spent 2 years dealing with steel, iron, etc. But we do have another day coming up, and that is Wednesday, which was not originally in the package. We were due to close on the 2nd, as you all know. But there's some issues that have really become more pertinent for us just to give more time. Unfortunately, we do have certain constraints, and we must indicate that. But thank you very much, Mr. Bob Stone, for that. And now we have Mr. Paul O'Flaherty, Chief Executive Officer from ArcelorMittal.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. We'll get right into it, and I will stick to the time. I think the first fundamental issue we'd like to start off with is that without a competitive steel industry, we will not have a competitive manufacturing industry in South Africa. And although our final users, the local content or the steel content in their products is between 5 and 25% of our major users, the fact is that if internally as a country we're not maximized in what we do, we cannot boost exports out of the manufacturing sector, and we certainly can't fight the imports. So just as an overview, from ArcelorMittal point of view, South Africa produces about 55 million tons of iron ore per annum. It's 5% of the world's product. 45 million of that is exported, and the rest is used internally, of which we are the major user. And you can see we get our iron ore from basically the Sishen mine, and also get iron ore from Thabazimbi. We're also a major user of coal in the country. We don't get all our coal, coking coal specifically, we don't get from South Africa, but you can see we get from Grootgeluk and Chikondeni mine. Our capacity is to... We can produce about 5.9 million tons of steel. per annum. We are only producing just over 5 million tons, and you can see it from our major works in Saldanha, in Vanderbijl Park, in Newcastle, and a small operation that we have in Vereeniging. And then we also have a number of byproducts, coke being one of them. Okay. Just from a footprint point of view, we are up the food chain, so we are in the upstream of primary steel making. Directly and indirectly, ArcelorMittal as a company contributes more than 1% of the GDP of the country. We employ over 15,000 people directly into ArcelorMittal, and our procurement chain is about 25 billion rand worth of spend in the country. Last year, although we're a loss-making company, we contributed 1.5 billion rand in taxes to the economy. So we are a significant developer and industry in this country. We have a number of challenges. We obviously are a steel producer, and then therefore our environmental footprint is a negative, and we have to deal with those. But we're definitely a catalyst for change of what needs to be done in South Africa. You asked us to go through the basic stages of production. So from an integrated point of view, you can see that we use about 6.5 million tons of iron ore, about 4.5 million tons of coal and scrap, and also various fluxes, about 1.5 million tons. We use close to 4 terawatt hours of electricity, so that's probably just under 2% of Eskom's supply. We have water intake of 19 million litres, or close to 20 million litres, and as I said, we employ close to 15,000 people. Our revenue last year was around 32 billion, and although we had a positive profit from operations as a company, because of the pressures we find ourselves under, we produced a loss. We have two major products at the primary steel. We produce flat steel and we produce long steel, and we'll go a bit into that. We produce primarily for the domestic market, but we also, where we can, take advantage of export markets where the demand in South Africa is subdued, and that's mainly through our Saldanha operations. In terms of socio-economic input, we contribute significantly in our footprint around our operations. Next one. So our major production is divided into two. Firstly, the flat steel. At the primary level, we used blast furnaces. You can see our input of coal, iron ore, and sinter. And basically, out of this process, in the flat section, you get slabs, which are then rolled, hot rolled and cold rolled for further selling to steel merchants and major steel manufacturers who then beneficiate the product further. We also have the long steel, which is a similar process, but in there we produce billets, and those billets then get rolled into various amounts of rod, bars, etc., and this is mainly used in the construction industry. And then we have a byproduct, a major byproduct, coke, which is sold primarily to the ferrochemical industry and the ferrochrome industry, and this, although not where we paid a lot of attention from people who know ArcelorMittal, is a significant contributor to that industry. Okay. In terms of our products, we are a primary steel producer, and therefore we are in the upstream of the steel production. And you can see for the years up to 2013 and for the half year of 2014 that we are not producing close to full production. This is a combination. Full production would be about 5.5 million tons, and we're producing about 4.5, and this year probably similar. This is mainly due to internal issues with our production lines. That's our issue. But then the external issues in terms of the markets and the subdued market we find ourselves in. You can see the flat steel products, the various types that we have, and also the various splits of long steel products. Those are then sold, as I said, to steel merchants and major steel manufacturers and beneficiated much more down the value chain. Okay. In terms of our cost breakdown, you can see the significant costs. We've compared 2012 to 2013 and the first half of the year for 2014, and you can see the year-on-year change. Basically, if you took the first half of 2013 versus 14, our costs have gone up by about 12%. And I'll talk about what is imported cost and what is local. But in terms of scrap, in terms of coking coal, electricity, all our costs are on the up. The manpower and maintenance is really a factor of production because we regard those as fixed costs. So those need to be better controlled with additional production. Average steel prices in the first half have gone up 8% and costs are going up by 12%. So you can see the challenge that we face. Okay. In terms of our inputs, iron ore is 100% South African, and then we beneficiate the iron ore through our process. Our pellets that we use are all imported. Our scrap is all local. And then where we have our big challenge is in coking coal. South Africa's coking coal doesn't suit our operations, and most of our coking coal is imported. The rest of our coal we use from local sources. So what does ArcelorMittal do to promote downstream beneficiation? Firstly is that ArcelorMittal has an export rebate scheme, and we encourage downstream manufacturers to export, and in terms of that scheme, you can see for the 2013 year, we contributed 230 million rand to downstream industry, and you can see what we've contributed over the years. We also, as a steel primary steel manufacturer, contribute to the COSM levy, and that levy is then available to the downstream industry to access. To gain advantage when they beneficiate and when they export. So in total last year, about 320 million rand that ArcelorMittal contributed directly in the downstream industry. Okay. So there are a couple of highlights where we've highlighted certain companies where there's been obvious benefits. So if you think about our downstream steel manufacturers, it would be in the fabricated structural steel industry, in the tubes and the pipes, the fasteners, the nuts, the bolts, the drums, the packaging, the rail products, rebar, foundries, domestic appliances, automobile. But you can see some of the areas in which downstream industry has benefited through the rebates and incentive schemes we have created. And more recently, ArcelorMittal have made fairly significant upgrades into our mills to supply into the renewable energy space, particularly in the wind industry, to make sure that we keep those initiatives local. In terms of beneficiation, as I said, we supply primarily to steel merchants. And steel merchants really like Max Steel. Would be in the warehousing, the cutting, the bending, the drilling, and the transport part of the operation. They then sell to downstream steel manufacturers such as Roval, where there's further beneficiation of the product down to the final product in Roval's case, which would be pipes. And you can see that these are our major customers from an ArcelorMittal perspective. And then there's a whole host of industries below that. You can see the major industries where our product goes, both from an import and an export, to the building and construction industry, which is our largest, to the mining, to the automotive, to the energy, and of course to the transport industry as well. So critical factors for beneficiation from our point of view and from what we see from our customer point of view is many of the issues that have been described very adequately already. Labor cost and productivity, high electricity costs, high transport costs, high port costs, and inflated electricity prices because of we have to, as ArcelorMittal, buy from the municipalities as opposed to direct Eskom. There's also very little trade protection for primary steel products. We don't see much cooperation at this point between, and this is a good step today that we can see in getting all of us together to talk about these issues. The unreliable electricity supply and the shortage of electricity is a specific issue for us, particularly in our Saldanha operations in the Western Cape, where we have 4 to 5 hours of load shedding each day. There's obviously a high cost of doing business in South Africa. And certainly downstream, we don't believe there's enough incentives to support local beneficiation, both in terms of countering imports, where there's a lot of there's subsidization of those imports by the Chinese and the Indian governments, which makes it less competitive for our industry. And there certainly is a limit of export incentives for the downstream manufacturing industries. So designation and localization are obviously two concepts we very much support. We have heard recently in the budget speeches of the DTI and also the economic development about designating steel for certainly the public sector projects that are coming out and in terms of the localization. But we have been down this road and we have seen many challenges around the control over these types of designations. And we need to work together to make sure that all of us achieve what we need to achieve out of designation and localization going forward. So just in closing, ArcelorMittal supports the National Development Plan of South Africa and supports the GDP growth requirements that are required. So as an example, if we take the iron ore and the coal and what that could be that we use and beneficiate, that could be exported for about 13 billion rand. We, through our processes, add an additional 20 billion rand through our beneficiation, even in the upstream of steel making, to produce the product that we have. So we are fundamental to beneficiation of our natural resources. Also from a job creation point of view, through the industries that we support as ArcelorMittal in the steel merchants and certainly down to the manufacturing industries, with the product that we have, we create and we add value through the entire industry to, we estimate around 900,000 formal jobs in South Africa. And lastly, if we follow what the GDP is required in terms of the National Development Plan, you can see that we do have spare capacity as ArcelorMittal. And by promoting localization, by providing more incentives to this industry, there is capacity in this country to add further value in the downstream. Thank you very much.
I'm going to hand over to Mr. Mkongi, but thank you very much. You know, Mr. Flaherty, we have already met you, I think, and so there is a relationship with us already. Thank you very much. Honourable Mkongi.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. I think we need to thank the presenters of all the presentations for this morning, and the last presenters that just finished now to present. But it is important to inform the meeting that Professor Turov won't be giving an input today. His input will be next week. So what will be following now, I will have to give members of parliament to ask questions, comments, and discussions on the presentations. Thank you very much. Okay, Honorable Fabs.
Yes, thank you, Honorable Mkongi. At least those who presented believe that there's been a walkout. There isn't. There's some folks who've gone off to hospital. others who have been urgently called to their parties to address critical issues, who had wanted to be here specifically for this input. So, and unfortunately that's beyond my control. But I do have a question, Honourable Chairperson, and that is, you know, one is mindful of the constraints that have been raised here, in particular steel industry, and one is very familiar with those constraints. But I come back to the old topic, and that is parity pricing. You know, perhaps ArcelorMittal has been able to change its model, but it would seem as if one can get cost plus 20%, why can't the 20% to some extent be passed on to the manufacturer? This is not a new question. It's something that I have referred to ArcelorMittal several years running, because the manufacturers say they're going out of business. They can't afford to pay the same price for the steel that they would by importing it, as it were. The other question, thank you, Chairperson, is to the steel producers generally. You know, the issue of skills has come up a great deal, but there is another issue here, and the issue is of transformation. You know, President Zuma has raised the issue repeatedly. We raised it in trade and industry in the fourth term. Why can't we get more and more black manufacturers? I mean this, frankly. I don't know, and I thought perhaps one of you would be brave enough to share some of these impediments. And why can't we get black industrialists? Is it because it simply is not no takers for it? No appetite? Or is it because it's very difficult to get in? We heard yesterday about what we call encumbered ownership. Is it so difficult to get in that it's virtually impossible unless it's a family business? Now, I know you're not all family businesses. We're aware of that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Fabs. Followed by Honourable Albert.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I have to apologize. I have to leave after posing my question, but I'm sure the answer will be captured by the committee. The submission from, I'm just trying to see, excuse me, from Mr. Papenfuss, you made an interesting submission, and I get the sense that you would like to see, in terms of the labor relations problems that we face, that there should be a dualist approach where you have the Labor Relations Act applying to larger enterprises and then SMMEs that's being hamstrung by the LRA or any other labor-related regulation be treated somewhat differently. And I think my sense is that it connects with Honourable Fabs's question regarding black industrialists. I think it might not just be black people that's having problems getting into the industry, it's people in general. And that it's the way it's structured to a degree, and it has to do with, I think, with the labor, one of the labor problem is one of the factors that plays a role in that regard. And what I would like to see, perhaps, is a presentation from yourselves that would give us an indication how you would see the labor relations structure be ordered or be structured in future, so that we can try and address that, because we know that is a problem. Hopefully we can, in this committee, be more pragmatic about that. It lies with, obviously, the Department of Labor and the Labor Committee itself. But our committee is probably the middle of the wheel as far as the economic structure of committees are concerned, and I think we do have some influence on the other committees to try and get things going in this country and try to create more jobs and create more entrepreneurs. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Albert. Honourable Sir.
Thank you, Chair. My first question will be directed to Mr. Papenfox, that he should really be able to elaborate a little bit about the big and small debate the presentation is talking about, so that we have clarity as we go on with our work as the committee. The other one, Chair, is to Mr. Henk, around administered prices. Particularly, I would like really to comment in relation to physical infrastructure, that here the presentation is saying sometimes this particular matter is underestimated as significant inhibitors. But we'd like to say, as the committee, we have received a full presentation from DTI, and it was very open and transparent to us that some of the challenges companies are facing in South Africa is because of physical infrastructure. They didn't really run away from that particular matter. They put it very clearly. So we are well aware that it is one of the challenges which are facing companies. Hence, as the committee, we have even recommended that we must also be able to meet with other government departments, because industrial policy doesn't solely lie with the DTI, but other role players are also supposed to come on board, and we have already resolved around that particular matter as the committee. The last one, Chair, is to ArcelorMittal. I think, Chair, ArcelorMittal is supposed to come out very clearly to us, so that some of the issues which are presented to us as a committee in this colloquium, we should be able really to address them as a portfolio committee. Like the issue of irregular awarding of contracts, because it is really a general statement. If it could really be specific, we can be able to put the chairperson in confidence, so that we are then able to deal with this particular matter, because this document is going to become a public document, and we can't leave really unattended, including the use of incorrect tariffs, so that we resolve that particular matter with the department. And lastly, lack of transparency regarding targets and local content definitions. Maybe you can request really to meet with the chairperson in confidence, or the committee, so that we understand exactly what is happening, and we are able as the committee to come up with the solutions going forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members. I think there's one question that is cutting across the board, which I don't want this to be missed, is to use beneficiation to advance transformation. You know, because everyone that has spoken already supports beneficiation, but there's nothing that says how do we enforce transformation. Thank you. I will go according to the presentation. We'll start by Niyasa to answer a few questions, and then we go to SAFSA, and then Zim Group, and ArcelorMittal. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. First question I'll deal with was raised by Mr. Albers. We don't want a dual approach in terms of the Labour Relations Act in itself. What we want as small business is that the playing fields be levelled. I think I will link up with the question on the big and small. Collective bargaining is a very strange animal. We don't have a problem if a deal is struck between one group of people, employers and trade unions. And as long as it's their deal, that's fine. What happens in collective bargaining is that those deals get extended to parties that are not part of their deals. And that's where the difficulty comes. When the Minister of Labour must make a call on whether or not to extend a deal, she doesn't count the number of employers in the industry. She only look at the number of employees on the one side, and on the other side she only look at the numbers of employees employed by business. Here's the trick. If you have in an industry one business employing 1,000 people, and in the same industry you have 1,000 small businesses each employing one person, and the one big business strike a deal with the union and goes to the Minister of Labour and ask her to extend that deal to the other 1,000 businesses, the minister will do so. He can put the 1,000 out of business with one deal. So this is the most unconstitutional and most undemocratic arrangement that you can think about. Somehow people think that keeps collective bargaining alive. This will eventually, Madam, the end of collective bargaining. Unless, what is happening here is that small business, which has a particular approach, which has specific needs, at the end, cannot raise their voices. And so the deals are killing small business. And I think if we want small business in South Africa and the place where real job creation will take place, if we need to address it, we want to address it, we have to make small changes in the Labour Relations Act only in respect of one particular section of the Labour Relations Act, and I will not go into detail. So we're not saying revamp the whole Labour Relations Act, we're talking about one particular section of the Act and to address that particular point. So what is happening here, and I think, you know, you're talking about black industrialists. Well, only black industrialists. Nobody has an interest anymore to get into this industry. For a startup, it's impossible. It's a no-go area. And this needs to be addressed. If my son was to ask me, Dad, must I start a business in this area? I said, go anywhere else. Don't get in there. So this is the big, small debate. And again, no big changes to the Act, but I think this is... And your voice in this regard will be appreciated, ma'am. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you very much. Sisa?
Sure, thank you very much. I'll take one question, the question related to transformation, and my colleague will deal with the question related to administered prices and infrastructure challenges. The observation made is absolutely correct. This is a sector that is way behind many others with regards to transformation. So that observation is correct. And part of the reason is that we have many small players that are family owned. So the point being made about small business is not one that applies just to an organization. There are many small companies that are our members, and many of them are family-owned, and there is not an excuse for not advancing transformation. We have, as CIFSA, decided to set up an enterprise development fund to make possible the opportunity of people who want to get into the sector and those who own these companies that have owned them traditionally to consider entering into partnerships with black players. But there it is, that there's a lot more that needs to be done to advance transformation in this sector is absolutely true. And as I'm saying, as CIFSA, we have won this particular intervention that we've come up with, and we're going to seek to promote and hope that many come forward and make use of the opportunity to make sure that they're better transformed.
Thank you, Chair. Just to add to that, about 1,000 of the companies in the CIFSA fold of about 2,000 is below 35 million. So just to give you an idea of the who would be exempt, and it is a massive job, and it's a lot of small companies involved. If I can talk about the infrastructure, I'm totally in agreement with you. We saw what the DTI is doing, we saw what your committee is doing, and we're really on the same page about it. The problem is it is there. You have this long transport cost. Bob said to me earlier that 75% of his transport cost is from Johannesburg to Durban. From there on it's 25. So it's easier to get something here than to get it out. And it stays there. I mean, I'm amazed at Mr. O'Flaherty's statement about Saldana and the electricity. I mean, in other words, if he works 24 hours, 5 hours of the 24 hours he can't produce. So it stays there, and it's like a block on a sprinter's foot. And it is a long-term, there is only a long-term solution. I mean, we will have combinations of saving, combinations of green energy will help, but on the margin, it's something that stays there. I want to say something about micro infrastructure in local authorities. It is a major problem. There are companies in some local authorities that consider moving because the electricity is so volatile, and they're never certain about it. And an international buyer is laughing at you when that happens. So it stays there. The administered prices, there's a combination of them, and you saw the list there. I again want to say something about the local authorities. In some cases, BUSA did a study on the percentage of income at local authorities that are cross-subsidized by selling of electricity and or water. In some cases, it's as high as 40%. So the argument is we raise the prices so you're going to use less. The moment we use less, budget constraints bites. So the incentives are almost perverse in that sense. And that's really, I think, the conundrum that we all need to struggle with. They are there and they don't go away. So how to get out of it, how to get out of that block is the real question. And we really need to work together. And again, I must say, what DTI is doing put the case of the industry is fantastic. I think we can work much better with you and support you.
No, thank you very much. I must also apologize. You know, this parliament is very, very busy. Now, chairperson of the portfolio committee is supposed called, by the way, someone to a meeting by the speaker. So if she leaves the room, you must not be surprised. Zimco Group.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I did not recall a question specifically to the Zimco Group.
Axel Metal.
Thank you. Honourable members, we need to have further engagement. We've always been talking about import parity pricing. But we need to be mindful of the state we find the industry in and the significant losses that we incur. And those losses are self-inflicted. In other words, we're not producing to the best that we can. We benchmark ourselves across the entire ArcelorMittal group worldwide, and we don't. But on the other hand, is all the challenges we spoke about today that affect our cost base. So we spoke about labor productivity. If we benchmark ourselves steel per head in South Africa against any other ArcelorMittal factory worldwide, we're definitely in the lowest. We are unproductive. Electricity prices are significant for us. Transport challenges definitely our rail freight is a major challenge. We talk about it, ArcelorMittal, that we regard Durban as halfway between China and Thunderbell Park because we can get product to Durban the same as that comes in from China, same price. Those products are subsidized. So we can talk import pricing parity, and we agree that we have to be more competitive. We agree as ArcelorMittal, but we need to open it up to a much more bigger debate, which is what you're doing, and look at the entire cost base that's affecting us. And when we can sit here and say that we are really, really efficient, then we can talk about what are those prices that need to be going down to the downstream. It's no good. We are in significant losses for the last 4 years. So these are the challenges that we face. And Honourable Member, thank you for the opportunity to talk about these issues that we highlighted on one of our slides.
I just want to clarify that we didn't mean by the word irregular that it's illegal. We meant by the word irregular that it's not routine, that it's not on a regular pattern that we can predict when the next projects are coming out. That's what we meant by that specific word. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will now give Honorable Tsoko to give us or make the closing remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you for everybody for having really honored the invitation from the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. We welcome all the presentations which are made today, and I think they will be able really to strengthen whatever we'll be doing in the Fifth Parliament. Particularly, the role of value addition extends beyond minerals to raw materials such as wood, forestry, agricultural products, recyclable materials such as scrap metals, which are labor intensive and less energy intensive than others. Plastic polymers can also contribute significantly to job creation, as the presentation will also indicate in today, and our own GDP, if cost of inputs and the constraints such as parity pricing on local industries is addressed. We welcome the proposals, including those which recognize the critical role of strategic, the critical role the skills play in this particular program. The committee also acknowledged that manufacturers should position themselves more strategically to compete more effectively. Steel is the basis for infrastructure such as transport. And I think some of the constraints we have also presented to us this afternoon will not end up with the committee of Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, but will also be able really to direct them to those relevant portfolio committees we are dealing with, as we have already resolved as the committee, that maybe we need really to call upon, like it was said in the Portfolio Committee, Honorable Chairperson, that we must call on interministerial committee to meet, especially which are playing a particular role on beneficiation, including departmental committee. Those are some of the resolutions we'll be tabling also in Parliament, including the parliamentary committee. Because as we talk about transport costs, we are not the relevant committee to address that, but the Portfolio Committee on Transport. Energy, there is also another Portfolio Committee which must also be able to address the particular challenges, including challenges of municipalities. Fortunately, we have already identified those as some of the hiccups and hindrances as regards the program which DTI wants to implement in the country, and it is really affecting a lot of people. So you have today confirmed exactly what we are discussing in the Portfolio Committee, that something must be done, and it must be done quickly. And if it is done, those particular committees are supposed to be in existence to see how best could we be able to address some of the issues. Like Mr. Henk was indicating, they have been staying there for some time. And I think, like the President was indicating in Parliament during the State of the Nation address, he put it very clearly: radical economic transformation. Because we shouldn't only be looking at the side of Parliament. I think a particular question was asked, which I think companies are also supposed to come out very clearly and openly to us in a very transparent manner around ownership, so that as we address our part of the side, they also address transformation on the other side. I thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much. That concludes the business of the day. We will meet next week on Tuesday, on the 2nd. And thank God I'm encouraged.